Hello and welcome to part two of our series of podcasts on the latest advances in cervical and endometrial cancer, A Global View. Last time we learned about some of the key highlights within the special issue and a fantastic paper detailing some of the challenges providing cervical cancer care in low and middle income countries. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Professor Karen Canfell about the global strategy for cervical cancer elimination. Professor Canfell is the director of the Daffodil Centre, an institute jointly supported by the University of Sydney and Cancer Council New South Wales, and she's also a professor and NHMRC Leadership Fellow within the Faculty of Medicine and Health at the University of Sydney. Karen, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you very much for helping us to bridge the time zone divide by having this interview at 5:30 a.m. your end. It's really kind of you, and speaks to your devotion to this cause, really. And I was really taken by how well constructed the article was that you co-authored with other members of the research community. And I just wanted to focus in a little bit around that then, because in that article, you talk about the goal of elimination of cervical cancer, which sounds a very ambitious goal. So can you tell us a bit more about, you know, the background to that and what led the WHO to sort of set up this kind of initiative?
Absolutely. Well, the elimination initiative has been in play for a few years now, and it really came off the back of a number of innovations in cervical cancer control over the last couple of decades. So, I mean, key to this call for elimination is the discovery that virtually all cervical cancers are caused by the human papillomavirus, or HPV. And so that really opened up two exciting possibilities for both primary and secondary prevention. So primary prevention with prophylactic vaccination against HPV, which protects young adolescents who haven't been exposed to HPV for their lifetime, we hope, against acquiring it. And then secondly, secondary prevention, which traditionally has been performed with the pap smear or cervical cytology, but that insight that cervical cancer is caused by HPV led to much more sensitive testing or screening for cervical cancer using the molecular test for the virus itself. So these were the insights that really led to the development of incredibly effective prevention initiatives. And this was already in the context of a cancer that, if caught early enough at an early stage, could be very effectively treated. So in 2018, the Director General of the WHO, Dr. Tedros, called to action around elimination, and over the next couple of years, many stakeholders, country stakeholders, WHO and its partners, put together a strategic plan for elimination. And this was signed off, discussed at the Executive Board of WHO in February 2020, and signed off in as part of the World Health Assembly in 2020, and then formally launched in November 2020. So, of course, the timing of all this has absolutely coincided with the COVID-19 pandemic, and that has probably impacted timing. It certainly impacted cervical cancer services in many countries. But nevertheless, elimination is an important challenge and an important goal. And we're really emphasising that the targets that have been set have really been conceived as 10-year targets, and so that they're still important for countries to be thinking about and planning. And those targets are around three pillars of elimination: vaccination, screening, treatment.
Thank you so much. And you alluded right at the end there about the three pillars. Can you tell us a little bit more about those?
What we're really looking at in terms of elimination is scaling up proven and effective interventions across three domains or three pillars. And so those are the three pillars actually of cancer control. It's primary prevention with vaccination, secondary prevention with cervical screening with a high precision test like HPV, and then effective delivery of effective treatment to women that require it either for a detected precancer through screening or treatment for invasive cervical cancer for those women that require it. And alongside of that, there's also the need to, of course, deliver appropriate supportive and palliative care services for those women that require it. So the targets that have been set for the year 2030 are what we call the 90-70-90 triple intervention target. So by that year, the aim is to have 90% of young girls globally, that's age 9 to 15, vaccinated against HPV, 70% of women screened a minimum of twice in their lifetime with HPV screening, and 90% of women that have the need for treatment being able to access it. So those are what we're calling the WHO elimination targets. If this can be achieved, modelling that my team's been involved with others to support WHO and their planning has shown that this will set countries on a path to reduce cervical cancer rates to such a low rate that it will be considered to be eliminated. The threshold for elimination has been defined as 4 cervical cancer cases per 100,000 women per annum, which is an extremely low rate. And as I say, a rate low enough that it would be considered to be controlled. And we've shown collectively that if the 2030 goals can be achieved, then over 60 million women's lives will be saved over the course of the next century as a result of scaling up across these 3 intervention fronts. So it's a really worthwhile and important initiative. There will be many, many lives saved along the way, along the path to elimination. Elimination itself is a long-term goal. It may take many decades in some countries. It may be something that we can realise much more quickly in some countries, particularly in some high-income countries, but it may take decades in some low- and middle-income countries with a high burden of disease. But the key point is that along the path to elimination, there are many, many lives to be saved by delivering effective services. And that's the message that WHO and its partners are trying to get out there.
Thank you. And that's a really clear message you've delivered there and within the article. I just wanted to reflect on one of the numbers you gave there, which is that right? 60 million women's lives?
62 million.
62. Yes. So can you just tell me a little bit more about over what time scale then that might potentially be saved?
Yes, sure. That's certainly over the longer term. That's over the course of a century. And the key point here, and this is from the modelling that we did as part of the what's called the WHO CCEMC, the Cervical Cancer Elimination Modelling Consortium. And this brought together three expert modelling groups over the course of the period between 2018 and 2020, working with WHO and other partners to do this exercise. And I actually, before I tell you about the results, I want to acknowledge our partners, not only at WHO, but also the other two teams from Harvard University and Laval University in Canada, as well as my team, which is now at the Daffodil Centre at the University of Sydney. So what we did is we modelled the scale-up of these three pillars, vaccination, screening and treatment, and showed that we would avert a very, very large number of cervical cancer cases, over 74 million cases, and save these 62 million women's lives over the long term. But I think even more importantly than those numbers, which are big numbers realised over a long time, is to understand the timing of the impact of the three pillars, because the key insight that, of course, didn't come only from this modelling, but which has really became, very overt through the modelling that we did, is that vaccination, we really have to keep in mind, is the long-term, what we call the long-term game changer. But we're delivering a vaccine in young adolescent girls that will protect them against a cancer which would, if it occurred, peak in mid-adult women and in older women. And so that implies a delay of several decades before vaccines' full effect will be realised. It's a long-term game changer because it will protect, with broad-spectrum vaccines that we now have, it will protect those young girls for life, but it's a long-term game changer, and it's a prophylactic vaccine, so it doesn't deal with the fact that hundreds of millions of women today have likely been exposed to HPV and won't be protected by a vaccine designed for adolescents. So then that second prong, cervical screening, is really the intervention that will protect, you know, those hundreds of millions actually of adult women that are really not of the age that can be vaccinated most effectively, where screening is the best intervention. And then then addressing a very critical and dire need for access to cancer treatment services will have an even more proximal effect, because cervical cancer, if treated effectively, does have a relatively good survival. One of the most rapid impact measures that we could take is to scale up cancer treatment services. Now, this is a very difficult and challenging pillar, but unfortunately, even pre-pandemic, for many low and middle income countries, access to cervical cancer treatment was sitting at around 20 to 30% at best. And clearly that's going to be even more adversely affected in the pandemic. So that scaling up cancer treatment services would have a rapid impact in the next decade to improve mortality rates. It would actually, if it could be done, would reduce those rates by a third, which is extraordinary. Screening would be the intermediate term deliverable that would really protect women over the next few decades. And then longer term vaccination will kick in. So the idea is that three pillars, we have to act on all three fronts within the next few years, but then their action will actually have different time frames, but they'll complement each other over time. Really, while we activate these proximal interventions of screening and cervical cancer treatment, scale up, and then in the long term, vaccination will be the game changer.
Thank you so much for that. And focusing then on that first pillar around vaccination, I mean, vaccines are very much in vogue right now in the context of the pandemic. So just a couple of questions around that. And firstly, around the effectiveness of the vaccines right now, where do we see the vaccines going in terms of their technology? And also, do you see similar challenges around hesitancy and take-up of vaccines as we have done during the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, I've talked and reflected with colleagues on some of the parallels. And in fact, we've even gone so far as to, in another paper with my colleague Ophira Ginsberg, equate cervical cancer to a slow-moving pandemic where, like COVID, there is in fact effective vaccination. There is effective treatment and there is effective screening. Obviously, things play out a little bit differently. In the case of HPV, the vaccines have been now out there for almost for about 15 years. So Australia, for example, was one of the first countries in the world to introduce a national publicly funded vaccine program. So that was back in 2007. So they were originally licensed in 2006-2007. And they've always been very, very effective as prophylactic vaccines. So close to 100% efficacy, so in the high 90s for efficacy, if the recipient hasn't been exposed to HPV. So that in that prophylactic situation, they're highly effective. So there were two first generation vaccines, the bivalent vaccine and the quadrivalent vaccine, coming from different manufacturers. Both of them protect against HPV 16 and 18, which are the highest risk types of HPV and which underlie about 70% of cervical cancers. One of those vaccines also added in HPV 6 and 11, which cause the majority of anogenital warts. So that was the original Gardasil vaccine. And then the bivalent vaccine, Cervarix, protected against 16 and 18. Now, since that time, there has been a second generation vaccine, a non-avalent vaccine, which adds in another five types to the quadrivalent, essentially. And these types are responsible for an additional approximately 20% of cervical cancers. So in aggregate, that second generation non-avalent vaccine protects around 90% of cervical cancers in effectively vaccinated females. And since that time, we've also seen very convincing data as well that there is quite good broad spectrum protection from the bivalent vaccine via cross protection. So that's good news because it means that we do have at least two vaccines with broader spectrum protection against a number of HPVs that cause cervical cancer. And there are also, I will mention, there are also several important efforts to manufacture new vaccines, both in China and India. And these will be critical to achieving consistent supply as we go forward with elimination. So the vaccines have been proven to be highly effective, with this one big caveat that they are prophylactic, they need to be delivered before exposure. And so, again, that's really why the second pillar is so important, because at least in the pre-vaccination era, what we saw was a pattern that a very large majority of people actually were infected with HPV, mostly the benign types. But the estimated lifetime risk of acquiring an HPV infection was at least 80% pre-vaccination. And so a very, very common infection. The pre-vaccination pattern in high-income countries was really that you saw a real peak in HPV infection in young girls after sexual debut, and that this then plateaued off as most infections are cleared naturally. And then for that proportion, that smaller proportion that persists, there's again a small possibility of them progressing, and that's really the highest risk then of that progressing to a cervical precancer or a cancer. So the vaccines are very effective, but they have to be delivered before, essentially before exposure to HPV, and hence that recommendation to focus on the 9 to 14 year olds as the highest priority group.
Thank you for that. That's really, really clear. And a very sort of basic question, but in terms of developing cervical cancer and invasive cervical cancer that sadly kills people, is it a necessity to have HPV? Is it as simple as that, or is that just part of the puzzle?
An extremely high proportion of cervical cancers have HPV underlying them. There is a little bit of controversy actually about the small proportion that don't appear to, and whether these are all true invasive cervical cancers or whether there may have been a little bit of misclassification. We do know that the so-called HPV negative rate for cervical cancer does increase in postmenopausal women. And again, there is a little bit of controversy about whether these may be true cervical cancers. But I think what we can say is that the vast proportion of verified invasive cervical cancers have HPV underlying them. And that is really the key, I think, to the success of HPV-based cervical screening, which is now a screening approach that many high-income countries are considering or transitioning to. The key point about HPV-based screening is that if you think about the natural history I just outlined before, the key point being with HPV screening, you can identify a woman being HPV positive it may not mean she has a lesion, a precancerous lesion or cancer. In fact, it most likely doesn't mean that. But what it does mean is that she is at some increase in risk of acquiring or progressing to pre-cancer and then to cancer in the future. And so the success of HPV-based screening is based not only on its sensitivity for detecting a lesion if it is there, but on its very, very strong predictive power for a woman's risk of actually developing invasive cervical cancer in the future. And so that really gives us a huge measure of control, I suppose, in concert with the woman to actually tailor her management according to her risk. And in speaking, for example, about the new HPV-based screening program in Australia, which I've been deeply involved in, what we're actually doing is we're using HPV testing to classify women using, if you like, a traffic light system. So HPV negative women, green, we know they're at extremely low risk for the next 5 to 10 years. In our screening program, they'll go back now to a 5-yearly screening interval, because just simply because in that time there's an extremely low risk of acquiring the virus if they don't have it, of it then progressing and persisting. Then we have women who have the types other than 16 and 18, these other oncogenic types. They are at some risk of progressing to a precancer, but not as high as for 16 and 18. So we classify that group as amber or intermediate risk. And depending on the results of reflex triage testing, we may refer a subgroup of those with high-grade cytology straight away, and or many of them can be managed with one-year follow-up. And then women who have HPV 16 and 18 at screening, we consider higher risk and refer immediately for colposcopy and for evaluation. And over the last couple of years, we've been really implementing the first round of screening using this approach in the Australian context, and it has been extremely successful, and we have some very important results coming out from the program showing that this approach can really detect a large number of covert cancers in that first round of screening. That's very, very important because it is a more sensitive test. So that's the power of HPV-based screening. And that's very, very important. You know, the article that we're talking about today was about progress towards elimination in high-income countries. And the power of HPV screening is a really important key to this in high-income countries. The other aspect that we haven't yet touched on, which is really important to think about in terms of HPV screening, is that it opens up this entirely new possible model of delivery and access to screening, because we now have quite a lot of evidence that HPV self-collection, where a woman collects her own sample, is also very effective if the right type of lab-based PCR test is used. And so this opens up huge new models, even in high-income countries, obviously in low- and middle-income countries, but even in high-income countries with many groups of women who've experienced barriers to access screening and for whom the choice to self-collect their sample could be a really important facilitator of actually taking up and participating in cervical screening.
Thank you. You make a really compelling argument, both on the vaccination side and also on the screening side there. Just going back to the vaccinations, then, you know, there's such a compelling argument there, but are there any concerns around safety associated with the vaccines, or what other things might be driving low vaccine uptake?
Well, actually, in many countries, there has been very good vaccine uptake. So our article actually used our recent article on eliminating cervical cancer in high-income countries actually used a couple of case study countries as examples. It was a mixed group of authors from Australia and UK, so we did focus on our own countries. But in fact, if we just consider those countries, in fact, we have had very high vaccine uptake in both countries. well over the 80% mark for full course delivery. We started with HPV vaccination originally with a 3-dose schedule, and then over the last few years, a 2-dose schedule has been approved. And in I think where we're all hoping this will head is the underpinning and the evidence to support 1-dose vaccination. And the HPV research community and clinical community is currently awaiting the results of some very important trials that have been set up with 4-year follow-up. But all indications from the observational analyses that have been performed are really that this will be also very effective. And if we look at 1-dose coverage, even in my country, in a high-risk population, Indigenous girls, a group that historically have experienced barriers and inequity in terms of cervical screening, for vaccination, the results are actually quite astounding. And in 3 jurisdictions, we've seen coverage at 1-dose at least of over 90%. So you can see with that kind of coverage, really vaccination is well set up as the future game changer again in cervical screening. The other thing to say is that at that level of coverage, we do, of course, also expect some herd immunity in the population. So I think the prospects are good in many countries. Now, that's not to say that vaccine hesitancy doesn't exist. Of course, it exists. It's existed in HPV as for other vaccines. And we have, unfortunately, over the last decade, seen a number of adverse experiences driven by vaccine hesitancy. But we've also seen, in a couple of cases, some great case studies for countries in addressing that. There was, for example, an incident in the Island program where a really effective consortium of parents and stakeholders and schools and other partners got together to really jointly promote the benefits of vaccination and really turned around the coverage situation in a fairly rapid time. So certainly there have been incidents in a few countries, but I think when we see that partnership and that concerted effort by stakeholders to communicate the importance of parents having their children vaccinated for their protection against this really quite dreadful cancer, you know, I think that we've seen successful turnaround.
Thank you for that. And just keeping with that, in terms of the vaccine, then it sounds like, you know, there's been a huge number of women and young adults having received the vaccine, and you know, there doesn't seem to be any sort of concerns around a safety signal. The message would be to have the vaccine. Is there a long-term data to support that you only need that one vaccine as a young person, or do you expect that people will need boosters you know, later on in life?
Yeah, well, a couple of things to say. I wouldn't say there haven't been concerns. And as with other vaccines, there are some adverse effects. And it's important, of course, to be transparent about those. And the vast majority are very minor, like soreness at the injection site, etc. And there is a low proportion of adverse effects. And this is something that WHO and countries and regulatory agencies, of course, monitor and report on regularly. But again, I think this very important important aspect of communicating that the benefits for most people will vastly, vastly outweigh the harms is really key. And we're seeing, of course, this play out in the COVID space as well. And I will say I'm not an expert in vaccine communications, but it's absolutely critical that we keep emphasising the health benefits of participating in programs, and indeed the incredibly adverse health effects of not participating. So to your question then about 1-dose vaccination, it's a very long lead in. So yes, look, I think there's been some very, very exciting observational analyses showing that it appears to confer duration of protection similar to two or three dose schedules. And look, it's difficult to put an exact time frame on it, but within the next year or two, there's great hope that we'll see results from the trials that are running now in several countries. NCI, the National Cancer Institute in the US, is running some key trials in Costa Rica, a key trial. And there's also an important India trial. And we expect these results to be available, you know, from what is known relatively in the relatively short term. And so this will be absolutely key, because if these trials, as expected, support the efficacy of one dose vaccination being approaching or being close to two dose vaccination, then that will clearly open up many simplified delivery models for vaccines. And that will be really important in terms of achieving the elimination targets, 90% of girls vaccinated against HPV. To achieve that in low and middle income countries, it will be vastly, vastly facilitated by having the opportunity to just simply do one dose vaccination, one jab. This could be, for example, done in a school-based campaign with the need to only access schools once in their lifetime. So that would be the that's the dream. Whether or not you would need boosters, I think that most certainly will be a longer term assessment that will be needed, and the trials that have been set up to look at one dose vaccination, I'm sure we'll be looking at that downstream as well.
Yeah, thank you for that. And just sort of nearing the end of the discussion then, in terms of the target set, they're certainly very ambitious. What do you think are going to be the main barriers to prevent these targets being met?
Yes, they are extremely ambitious targets, and we all of us who have been involved in it have been transparent about this at the beginning. They are designed as, if you like, stretch goals for countries. They're designed to inspire, and they're designed to show that if these targets, if and when these targets can be achieved, countries will be truly positioned to eliminate cervical cancer. So clearly, if there's a delay in realizing the targets, there'll also be a delay in cervical cancer elimination. But again, it's, you know, what we try to emphasize is that actions taken, even if they're impacted by local conditions or global conditions such as a pandemic, that there will be many lives to be saved on the path to elimination. So one of the, of course, the key challenges right now, I don't really even need to say it, but how do we actually balance the lives that could be saved by cervical cancer elimination with the other constraints that countries have and the other huge challenges at the moment on the ground? And that's a very, very difficult country-to-country concern. I think that there are many ways in which the pandemic is impacting efforts on cervical cancer elimination, some obvious and some not obvious. I mean, obviously, the huge disruption to health services is an obvious impact. Vaccine programs worldwide have been impacted, although many countries are successfully catching up. Cervical screening programs, where they exist, have been disrupted in many countries, and even when they haven't been formally paused, we've seen lower participation in many countries. And so I think that it goes without saying that cervical cancer elimination will be more difficult in the era of COVID. There are also challenges around both vaccine and HPV testing supply. And in fact, in the case of HPV testing, some of the reagents for testing needed by systems are the same as needed for COVID testing. So I don't think we're going to see how that plays out for a while yet. Certainly in the short term, it means there's competing demand for reagents. But in the longer term, there may be more consistent establishment of broad spectrum testing systems that can be harnessed for HPV testing as well as COVID testing in countries. So lots and lots of challenges with the pandemic, and it's very important, I think, for us to continue to work these through. I'm involved in an endeavour called the COVID and Cancer Global Modelling Consortium. You can see more about that at ccgmc.org. And that's a partnership with the International Agency for Research on Cancer and many other partners. And our efforts there are really to characterise the scale of the impact of the crisis on cancer, with cervical cancer, of course, being one of our main focus areas. We're doing some active work now on characterising the impact of delays on countries and looking at potential recovery or acceleration strategies if in some cases vaccine campaigns, for example, could be fast-tracked. So we're doing what we can to support countries in understanding the impact of delays and how best they might be able to really reset the scale up on across those three pillars at a moment when that becomes possible.
Thank you so much. And just a final question, really. And I just wanted to ask you, what advance or what recent advance are you most excited about then that you think is really going to help deliver on these goals and even beyond that?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, I'm thinking and planning a lot with our team at the moment is really in this area of HPV self-collection, which I mentioned. It is huge. And I've talked about vaccination being the long-term game changer. I think HPV self-collection is the sort of intermediate term game changer, because we've never had a screening approach where a woman can take her own sample for cancer of the cervix. And that's really, even in the best case, that's meant that participation has been very limited. For many women, there are so many cultural or individual barriers to the pelvic examination. And I think this new approach, it's actually not that new, but what's new is that we now have the evidence that we can achieve equivalent sensitivity. And this new approach just opens up so much choice for women to be, an active participant in their health. And I think this is just really going to be key. And I guess I'm optimistic. We've been struggling in countries that have had cervical screening programs. We've been struggling for decades around participation. And in a lot of countries, no matter what you do, with throwing so many investments and efforts at it, but no matter what you do, you can't get participation up beyond a certain fairly modest level of 60, 70% perhaps in the best case. But with self-collection, I think this could be a different story. And I think we could be starting to push beyond the 70% set by WHO, at least in some countries. And more importantly than that even, it's who we're accessing that we haven't been able to access and offer screening to. It's the high-risk women. It's women in from culturally and linguistically diverse populations. It's Indigenous women in several countries. And women that will find this, I think, a much preferred model of participating in screening. So I think this is going to be key, just as we talked about one dose vaccination for low and middle income countries being opening up a new set of models, a new gateway for making this successful. I think HPV self-collection is going to do it for screening. I think that's going to be the key enabler of scaling up screening in high-income countries and in low- and middle-income countries.
Thank you. On that really positive note, I just wanted to say thanks so much for your time today and sharing such expert insights. Thank you very much, Karen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.